Bridgebank helps breakthrough ideas actually break through and remains dedicated to providing financial solutions to the risk takers, the game changers, and the disruptors. Bridgebank, a division of Western Alliance Bank. Bridgebank, be bold, venture wisely.
Hey, it's Avery Trufelman, host of Articles of Interest. And I've got to say, I've been a fan of KQED ever since I was a little kid and I would come out to San Francisco to visit my grandma. It was just what we'd always turn on every time we got in the car, every time we were making dinner and turning on the radio. It was always KQED. And then over the years, I've become a massive fan of KQED podcasts because this is local reporting at its best. These are answers to questions you've always wanted to know, interviews with exciting, unusual voices, necessary journalism, all told with love and care and artistry. And did you know that a majority of KQED's funding actually comes from members? It's just people like you and me supporting the programs they love, while also getting access to cool events, behind-the-scenes footage, and so much more. If you want to sign up and be a part of this amazing community, visit donate.kqed.org/podcasts to become a member today. That's podcasts with an S. Thank you for listening, and thank you for your support.
From KQED.
Good morning. This is the California Report. I'm April Dymbosky in San Francisco. The state has pre-ordered 1.4 million doses of Pfizer's pediatric COVID vaccine, so medical providers can start putting shots in little arms as soon as federal health officials sign off. There are 3.5 million children ages 5 to 11 in California, 9% of the state's population. State epidemiologist Dr. Erica Pond says children deserve to be protected from COVID.
They've weathered remote learning, adapted to wearing masks, and put birthday parties and play dates on hold. These young heroes want to fully participate in life again. With holiday gatherings and festivities approaching, vaccine authorization could not come at a better time.
Public health officials say vaccine appointments will be available as soon as the end of next week. But reaching all eligible children will require outreach in vulnerable communities and at schools. As wildfires continue to burn longer and impact millions of acres of California land each year, Congress is considering legislation aimed at helping to suppress the fires before they start. The California Report's Keith Mizuguchi explains.
Two bills introduced in the House deal with the pay and job classification of federal wildland firefighters. One from Bay Area Congresswoman Zoe Lofgren would raise the max out limit on overtime pay for these firefighters. She spoke about the importance of the bill during a congressional hearing yesterday.
In California, most of the fires burning are on federal land, and the overtime pay cap for federal wildland firefighters is a significant hurdle in attracting and retraining our most experienced firefighters.
The other bill would increase pay for federal wildland firefighters and also provide critical services like healthcare, including mental health, along with a housing stipend. Kelly Martin, president of the advocacy group Grassroots Wildland Firefighters, testified during the hearing.
We are often the lowest paid people on the fire line in terms of working next to some of our state partners and some of the municipal firefighters as well. So what we're asking for is at least a review of the pay parity in terms of raising those wages and benefits.
Wildland firefighters have said pay is one of the main reasons why so many of them are leaving for other jobs. In fact, firefighters working for Cal Fire can often make more than double the amount wildland crew members make. For the California Report, I'm Keith Mizuguchi.
House Democrats are meeting this morning to work on passing President Biden's package of social service and climate change proposals. The president wants to have a plan in hand before he attends the big climate conference in Scotland next week. But the package is still facing an uphill battle in the Senate from within the president's own party. White House officials went to Capitol Hill yesterday to meet with Senators Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona and Joe Manchin from West Virginia. The pair have found themselves with a lot of power, essentially deciding whether President Biden will be able to deliver on his campaign promises. The California Report's Saul Gonzalez spoke with California's Senator Alex Padilla about the package, which has already been whittled down from $5 trillion to less than $2
trillion. I think at the end of the day, what more important than what the quote-unquote top-line number is what's in the bill. And it's going to be a pretty ambitious complement to the bipartisan infrastructure package that has already been approved by the Senate. So the number has come down, but I think the foundations that we're going to lay are solid and we'll continue to build on in the years to come.
What's a must have for you in this legislation?
Oh, my gosh. So there's so much in the process of the number coming down from the $3.5 trillion to whatever the final number might be. I know there's been conversations and debate as to whether or not we bring the number down through wholesale exclusion of some important areas of investment. You know, do we lop off healthcare? Do we lop off education? Do we lop off housing? Do we lop? I disagree. I think by being targeted, focused, and maybe only funding 3-4 years of an important initiative as opposed to the whole 10 has been the better way to reduce the dollar figure.
So essentially, Senator, you're saying, hey, it's not everything I want. It's probably not going to be everything I want, but this is still well worth passing. Is that right?
There's going to be a lot of very, very good in this final package and taken together with the bipartisan package that's already been approved. It continues to be historic investments.
Do you appreciate the frustration of progressives who say, this isn't even the Republicans doing this. This is your party, Senator, doing it to itself, particularly because of the actions of Senator Manchin and Senator Sinema of Arizona. Is that frustrating to you that you're dealing kind of with a revolt from within your party and not Republican opposition?
I absolutely share the frustration, but let's also be clear. The reason we're having to navigate 50 Democratic votes is because Republicans refuse to participate. Republicans refuse to collaborate. Republicans are refusing to invest in so many areas of our nation's infrastructure and our economy that this is the only device that we have left. But budget reconciliation is a vehicle to make all this happen.
Are you frustrated with Manchin and Sinema? Just simple question. Are you with their actions and their positions?
Look, I've been in public service for 20 years. There's times I've been frustrated at the city council in Los Angeles, the state senate in Sacramento. That continues to be the case here because the process is the process. But I'm optimistic we're going to get something big and bold done here in the near future.
All right. Senator Alex Padilla, U.S. Senator for the great state of California. Thank you so much for joining us on the California Report.
Thank you. Continue to stay safe.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
Hi there. I'm Rund Abdelfattah from Throughline. If you're listening to this podcast, you know that KQED produces exceptional storytelling that keeps you informed, inspired, and entertained. Their podcasts cover issues from your neighborhood to the entire country and everything in between. Support this work today.
You can help us continue to bring quality podcasts to your ears. Just head to donate.kqed.org/podcast. That's donate.kqed.org/podcast.
The Beverly Hills Police Department has been accused of racially profiling Black shoppers on Rodeo Drive. New records from a class action lawsuit showed that out of 90 people who were arrested along the shopping corridor, 80 were Black. Alleged victims and attorneys say it's racial profiling 101. As KCRW's Tara Atrian reports, they're now urging the state to step in.
The Beverly Hills Police Department created a special unit dubbed the Rodeo Drive Team last year. The goal was to address what some residents and store owners said was a, quote, criminal element along the luxury shopping hub. But attorney Bradley Gage says the unit has been discriminatory.
Beverly Hills is only 2% Black. Our state is only 13% Black. Why were 90% of the arrests African American? You can't justify that.
Joseph Nett is one of the people who alleges they were racially profiled. He says he was a passenger in a car driving through when he was handcuffed and locked up for 3 days without being charged.
It happened because we were Black. Like, if we were white, we probably never would have been stopped.
The attorneys for the lawsuit are calling on Governor Newsom and Attorney General Bonta to open up an investigation into the department, saying if Beverly Hills doesn't act, they'll need to. Meanwhile, the BHPD says they remain committed to keeping their community safe, and that Nett was in violation of a restraining order when the car he was in was pulled over for a traffic violation. For the California Report, I'm Tara Atrion in Los Angeles.
The coronavirus pandemic led to record drug use across the country. Fatal overdoses rose almost 30% last year, driven mainly by fentanyl and other opioids. But the stimulant methamphetamine is also a huge part of the problem. It doesn't get as much attention, though, in part because it doesn't cause the impressive death counts that make for good headlines. You don't typically overdose on meth. You decay. That's how journalist and former LA Times reporter Sam Quinones describes it in his latest book, The Least of Us, True Tales of America and Hope in the Time of Fentanyl and Meth. An excerpt of the book appeared in this month's issue of The Atlantic. It charts the massive boom in the meth market and the insidious impact the drug has on people who use it. I spoke with Sam Quinones earlier about his reporting. Sam, in your story, you talk a lot about the market forces that have led to a boom in the availability of meth in the U.S. And one thing that fueled this that was fascinating to me was the legalization of marijuana. And it made me think of California, one of the first states to legalize pot, also one of the states with the largest influxes of meth. So what's the relationship there?
Well, the relationship is that marijuana has always been the gateway drug for Mexican traffickers. It's a staple that they've used to learn the business, to develop capital, develop contacts, and so on. And so when states in the United States, first California, began legalizing it, that meant that their market was taken away. And a lot of those folks gradually began to migrate to another part of the drug world, which is methamphetamine. And methamphetamine, just about that time, was emerging as the drug that you could make. The chemicals were there, and it just naturally was a place where people migrated once marijuana was not the solution to their economic problems that it had been for so many years.
And you're not subject to the weather or the vagaries of agriculture.
Synthetic drugs, they learned very early on, have the enormous benefit of never, you don't need land, you don't need irrigation, you don't need farmers, and you don't need to depend on the weather or the seasons. If you have the chemicals, you can make this stuff all year round. And that is exactly what we're seeing down in Mexico.
You write about this major shift in production of meth, where the cooks started using different chemicals to make it. Why did they do this, and how has that affected the market?
They switched because the old precursor with which they made meth, a chemical known as ephedrine, found in Sudafed pills, antihistamines, and so on, was made illegal, except for a few pharma companies to possess, by the Mexican government in 2008. And so by 2009, 10, 11, you begin to see all these producers switching to this new method known as the P2P method for the main precursor, which is a chemical known as phenyl to propanone. You can make P2P many, many different ways. There's all kinds of like chemical hacks you can use to get to P2P. That was the story I thought I was telling when I started telling a story of just the massive quantities these folks are now able to make methamphetamine. But along the way, I began to realize there was another story that was perhaps even bigger than that. And that is that the new way of making meth, the P2P meth, has been creating terrifying symptoms of schizophrenia in those who use it. Paranoia, horrifying hallucinations, and along the way, of course, it has led to a widespread homelessness among those who use it. And that was a stunning idea because I had not seen that reported anywhere. But the more I talked to people, the more I sought out folks, recovering addicts, drug counselors, cops, et cetera, all these different folks, the more I saw that this story was repeating itself all over the place. It was in LA, it was in Portland, San Diego. It was a scary thing because the quantities were unrelenting, which meant that all across this country, massive waves of mental illness and homelessness were being created by this drug that because of this new way of making it.
In San Francisco a couple years ago, 50% of people who were in the inpatient psychiatric unit of our emergency department were in for meth intoxication.
Yes. And I just got an email from a clinician in San Francisco an hour ago, literally saying exactly that. And what's more, it seems a common thing all across the country that clinicians and ERs and so on People don't know what they're presented with. Frequently, it's the symptoms of mental illness, but you don't know if it's simply created by methamphetamine or it's true mental illness that this person is suffering from. And what's more, meth users seem to be now taking up a lot of the resources that ought to be devoted to people who truly are mentally ill. I've seen this in other parts of the country as well, where they're just filling the clinics or filling the hospitals in spaces that really ought to be reserved for people who truly are mentally ill.
You write about a lot of these trends that we've been discussing through the eyes of a Southern California man named Eric Barrera. Tell us a little bit about how did he get into meth and how did he experience some of these changes?
There's a club called Skid Row Running Club in Skid Row in L.A., where a judge organized it. I talked to the judge and he was telling me about the horrible meth problems that they see on Skid Row. I went down to the run one morning very early and he said, you need to talk with a few of my guys. Why don't you talk to Eric? And so we met, Eric and I met, and he told me his story, which was that he got out of the Marines in 2000, came back to L.A., was kind of suffering from some depression, began to treat it with methamphetamine, but this was the ephedrine meth days. And then he told me, then one night the meth changed, he told me. Never forget when he told me this. We were sitting outside in a restaurant late at night in Pasadena. He said, then one night the meth changed and there was no more euphoria. There was no more being on top of my game, wanted to talk to everybody. It was serious, serious paranoia that my girlfriend was hiding a man in the apartment. First it was in mattresses and I took a butcher knife and started stabbing the mattress. And eventually he'd been using meth for 8 years on ephedrine meth and never been homeless. Now within a year or so, he's homeless, living in his car, dealing the drug. And he lasted about 4 years before finally getting sober and then became a homeless outreach coordinator, looking for vets, for veterans in the tent encampments. But what he also told me was, I don't know what happened and I don't know how to explain what happened to me, but I can tell you, after 5 years of working in homeless encampments, I'm seeing people all over Los Angeles that are going through the same distress, torment, and decomposition that I was going through. It's all around me. Everywhere, every encampment I go to, that's what I'm seeing.
You point out a striking contradiction here, that advocates for people who are homeless seem to willingly ignore meth use among the population because of a fear of stigmatizing the homeless as drug users. Where did this come from?
The problem is, I think we talk about homelessness as if it's one thing. It's not one thing. It's many different stories, many different things. I can say, though, with a great certainty that the kind of a homelessness that leads people to be in tent encampments without any hygiene, you know, the kind that you see all over San Francisco, that we see down in L.A. all the time, that is drug-induced, mostly, I would say, absolutely meth-induced. I'm stunned by how the media coverage in Los Angeles almost never about homelessness almost never mentions methamphetamine. The politicians almost never mention. They're charged with spending millions and millions of dollars, and yet the most fundamental problem leading to homelessness, they don't want to mention. It's very upsetting, weird, frankly. I don't get it. But once you get down into it, everybody you talk to will tell you that meth is the, as the one judge said, the enormous, you know, 800-pound gorilla in the room that nobody wants to even mention, that leads to bizarre policy solutions. Like, we need to put everybody in a house. If you put a meth addict who's on the P2P meth in a house, that house will not survive. We have to find another way of finding places where we can detox folks for months off this stuff, and then you can talk about treatment, then you can talk about housing, then you can talk about jobs, then you can talk about following the rules that will allow you to keep a house or an apartment. As it is now, the folks in these encampments are not housable.
And that's the California Report for Thursday, October 28th. We're a production of KQED Public Radio. I'm April Dymbosky. Thanks for listening.
Support for the California Report comes from Real California Milk, reminding listeners to take three simple steps to recycle gallon milk jugs. Pour it, cap it, bin it. Learn more at recyclethejug.com. Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose philanthropy harnesses the power of people and science to create innovative solutions for a healthy environment, just societies, and opportunities for human achievement, and Blue Shield of California, rebuilding the future of healthcare with every Californian in mind, from quality and equitable care to not-for-profit values. Learn more at news.blueshieldca.com.
Hi, I'm Sasha Coca, host of the California Report magazine. Every week, we bring you stories about what connects us in the giant, diverse Golden State. Because what happens in California changes the world.
I love this place. We were once seen as like the place to be, California. The land of milk and honey. That's where you go to Sunshine State. But we just have challenges right now.
KQED's California Report magazine. New episodes drop every Friday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, it's Glenn Washington from Snap Judgment. And if you love what you're hearing, and I know you love what you're hearing, please consider becoming a KQED member. You get special access to cool events, behind-the-scenes footage, and so much more. Plus, you'll sleep better at night knowing you did your part for the community you depend upon. It's in you. Please be in it. Visit donate.kqed.org/podcasts to sign up now. That's podcast with an S. Thanks.